Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In their own right and in their separate spheres, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson were stars. They were among the best-known public figures of their time, the same time, but we seldom associate them with one another. They both fought against racism and bigotry, but as our guest this week, Joe Dorenson, explains, they were also set up as adversaries. In a moment, Dorenson explains how and why. But first, Dan Roberts tells us about another odd couple who struggled with racism and worse a century earlier.
Abraham Lincoln did not always hold the views about freedom and equality he championed during the Civil War. There is evidence he was pushed in that direction by an ex-slave.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
When most people hear the names Lincoln and Douglas, they immediately associate the Civil War president with his arch-political rival, Senator Stephen Douglas from Illinois. But there was another Douglas in Lincoln's life. Frederick Douglass was an ex-slave born in Maryland, a constitutional abolitionist who, according to Professor Lincoln Robinson, may have contributed significantly to the evolution of Abraham Lincoln's ideas and policies concerning slavery and emancipation. Lincoln began the decade of the 1850s with views that were fairly typical of white men of his day. Eulogizing Henry Clay in 1852, Lincoln called the Declaration of Independence the White Man's Charter of Freedom. By 1858, during his famous debates with Senator Douglas, he criticized the little giant as restricting the Declaration's call for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to only rich men or white men. By the Gettysburg Address in 1863, Lincoln's views were closely paralleling those of Douglas, that, in fact, the Constitution knows all the human inhabitants of this country as the people. Lincoln echoed Douglas's sentiments when he called the war in that speech a conflict to fulfill the founders' proposition that all men are created equal. Shortly after Gettysburg, Lincoln and Douglas met for the first time, and in their conversation, the president asserted his full agreement with the latter's position. The producer of A Moment in Time is Steve Clark at the University of Richmond. This is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and the Vietnamese defeat of the French in Indochina. And both Vietnam and France are marking the event in their own way. On May 7th, the Vietnamese gathered at the site of the bloody 56-day siege that killed more than 2,000 French and three times as many Viet Minh soldiers and spoke of it as a major step in their winning national independence. As Defense Minister Pham Van Tho explained, his people's victory came as a shock to the rest of the world. But when a country realizes that national independence is above all else, no other forces can oppose them. France also remembered the battle, with President Jacques Chirac welcoming French veterans of the country's war in Indochina to a ceremony in Paris. Chirac praised the courage of French soldiers, who, he said, defended France's honor and presented Legion of Honor medals to 19 veterans of the battle. This is Talking History. Our guest this week, Joe Dorenson, has titled his remarks, A Double Play for the Ages. He speaks of Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson and their fight against racism and against others who sought to pit one against the other. Dorenson, professor of history at Long Island University, is co-editor of Jackie Robinson, Race, Sports, and the American Dream, and Paul Robeson, Essays on His Life and Legacy. His remarks were recorded at WNYE in New York City.
Two great figures in African-American history were brought together in the Cold War clash in 1949. Robeson's voice was unforgettable. New York Times critic Brooks Atkinson likened it to a cavernous roar. Another scholar described that unique bass baritone as sheer carpeted magnificence. The voice that defied silencing by inquisitors of the 1950s and by death in 1976, uttered its first cry on April 9, 1898, the day of his birth, to William Drew Robeson, a runaway slave, and Maria Louisa Bastille, an educated woman. Growing up sanely in an absurd society rife with Jim Crow segregation, he enjoyed a spectacular career as a scholar athlete. At Rutgers University, he won varsity letters in football, basketball, baseball, and track. He excelled in the classroom, too. Phi Beta Kappa, debate champion, valedictorian, Robeson towered above his classmates. After graduating from Columbia Law School, he abandoned legal practice for the theater. He roared in the 1920s as Eugene O'Neill's Emperor Jones and as Oscar Michaud's hero in Body and Soul. In 1928, Robeson electrified London audiences as Joe in Jerome Kern's Showboat. 2 years later, his Othello won rave reviews. After almost two decades abroad, Robeson returned to his native land. On November 5, 1939, he came to CBS Radio, where he sang Earl Robinson's Ballad for Americans. He was granted an honorary doctorate at Hamilton College in 1940, and the Donaldson Award, comparable to our Tony, in 1944 for his magnificent Othello. His meteoric rise brought him global fame. He seemed to embody the American dream in that giant frame, larger than life. He was a natural for the role of Goodwill Ambassador. On one of his many trips, he visited the Soviet Union in 1934. It produced a mutual love affair with serious consequences. Like Othello, he loved not too wisely, but too well. For the first time in his life, Robeson felt totally welcome, unfettered, adored, indeed lionized. As long as the common enemy was Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan, Robeson enjoyed large fame and modest fortune. The American press rarely criticized either his personal beliefs or his public statements. In fact, Paul Robeson reached a high point in 1943 when he starred in a Broadway production of Othello and led a delegation of Negro leaders and newspaper editors to a meeting of Major League Baseball owners and their czar, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, to petition for the entry of blacks into the citadel of our national pastime. Cordially received and effusively greeted by the commissioner, Judge Mountain Landis, Robeson had every reason to believe they had earned stature in the eyes of white America and had indeed paved the way for Jackie Robinson's entry 4 years hence. It seemed like a story crafted by and for a black Horatio Alger, but another Alger, Hiss, marred the Hollywood happy ending. Whitaker Chambers accused Alger Hiss, and Nixon Richard produced the Pumpkin Papers. The Cold War heated up in 1947, the threat of communist-led insurgency in both Greece and Turkey, the rising popularity of communist leaders in Italy and France, the coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948, the triumph of Mao's army in China in 1949, and the detonation of an A-bomb in Russia, breaking our nuclear monopoly, all contributed to worsening relations between the two superpowers, and Paul Robeson was caught in the crossfire. In that year, he told a Paris peace conference that it is unthinkable that American Negroes could go to war on behalf of those who have oppressed us for generations, against the Soviet Union, which in one generation has raised our people to full human dignity. Wrenched out of context, Robeson's remarks were taken literally instead of ironically. The AP conveyed the essential theme with a hostile variation. This interpretation painted Robeson into a corner, color him red. Robeson returned from Europe, angry and belligerent. He resented attacks on his patriotism. The famous singer defied, quote, any errand boys and Uncle Toms of the Negro people to challenge my Americanism, end of quote. Biographer Martin Duberman points out that Robeson retained much support in 1949, and the Council of African Affairs warned against a campaign to smear a man who stands up for civil rights. Why did this gifted man gifted beyond measure as singer, actor, athlete, scholar, prefer the restrictive regime of Russia to the democracy of his native land. Clearly, the critic Alfred Clausen concluded that the answer resided in America's refusal to admit all members to full participation as citizens. Robeson, Duberman contends, feared a preemptive strike. He feared a Dr. Strangelove scenario, which might have incinerated, through nuclear means, the major cities of Russia as well as the United States. To rebut and isolate Robeson, the House Un-American Activities Committee opened in mid-July. They summoned Jackie Robinson, the great Brooklyn Dodger star, to rebut Paul Robeson. The Brooklyn Dodger trailblazer felt constrained to comply. As Robinson remembered this confrontation, he faced a dilemma. After extended discussion with his beloved wife Rachel, mentor Branch Rickey, and Urban League executive Lester Granger, the brilliant second sacker framed a reply for his appearance on July 18th to give the lie to the statements by Paul Robeson.
You're listening to Joe Dorenson speaking on Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson.
The summons invited skepticism, and Jackie knew the score. He understood Robeson's rage and then white establishment's desire to get him. He realized that the target of the UAC committee was an embittered and bitter man who had suffered indignities from a Princeton childhood to his Rutgers College experience. Shunned in Nazi Germany while on tour in 1934, he was embraced in Soviet Russia. Nor was Robinson blind to the manipulation of his star-studded appearance. "I'm not fooled," he said, "because I've had a chance to open to very few Americans." He admitted that although he lacked expertise in politics, he knew his people and their experience intimately. He, too, vowed to continue the struggle against racial discrimination in society as well as in sports. Jackie did not want to tangle with the great singer-activist, but he could not accept Robeson's premise regarding the behavior of American blacks vis-à-vis the Soviet Union. Except for the stridently rhetorical and patently artificial last line that reinformed Jackie's determination not to squander his large investment in America because, as he said, of a siren song and bass, the rebuttal was fairly gentle. Indeed, Robinson qualified his critique of Robeson. "He has a right to his personal views, and if he wants to sound silly when he expresses them in public, that is his business and not mine." Jackie felt that no one leader could speak for all African Americans, certainly no one who was pro-Soviet. Perceptively, he understood the dynamics of doubleness imposed on blacks, the external fight and the battle within. Unable to back down, blacks had to fight on both fronts, double V for victory. Full representation in American society depended on service, including military service to the state. Quoting Jesse Jackson, Robinson quipped, "It ain't our government, but it's our country." Biographer Arnold Rampersad succinctly summarizes Robinson's delivery. In homespun language, leavened only now and then by humor, Jack offered himself as both a humble man and one proud of his deeds, keenly opposed to racism in America, but full of hope. Press coverage in the main reflected a strong anti-Robeson, pro-Robinson bias. The New York Times, for example, put Robinson's testimony on page one, and it added an editorial in support. But the paper did not dignify Robeson with a report on his press conference to answer the Dodger Star. In this remarkable two-hour exchange, referenced in our book, Paul Robeson, His Life and Legacy, Robeson refused to be baited into a frontal attack on Robinson. "As a matter of fact, Jackie said he was for peace, and I am too," Robeson said. "So let's start fighting for it." Robeson offered to testify and urge Negroes to affirm their knowledge about conditions in America. Robeson went on to blast the committee chair from the great state of Georgia for his defense of the Ku Klux Klan. He sneered at Congressman John Wood for his absence during Robinson's appearance, asserting that it was dictated by a refusal to call the witness Mr. Robinson. Why didn't the committee summon Joe DiMaggio? Robeson wondered aloud, to testify on the loyalty of Italian Americans. He went on to chide Robinson, albeit mildly, for playing ball with the enemy. He clarified his Paris statement, stressing the peace option in the face of war fever. He conceded that 85 engagements out of 85 had been canceled because of political reaction. He vowed to go on fighting. He concluded by denying they had written to Jackie in an effort to prevent his testimony, or saying that blacks would not fight in a war against Russia. Soon the heavy hitters were brought into action. Eleanor Roosevelt, the widow of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, favored Robinson, as did 239 Brooklynites surveyed by the Amsterdam News. In contrast, other members of the black press offered a more measured analysis. The Afro-American featured a cartoon that depicted Jackie Robinson as a frightened little lad brandishing a huge gun tracking Robeson's giant footprints. The caption read, "The leading player in the National Baseball League is only a tyro as a big game hunter." Educator J. A. Rogers defended Robeson as a loyal American. To his credit, Robeson refused to attack Robinson. "I have no quarrel with Jackie. I have a great deal of respect for him. He is entitled to his view. I feel that the House committee has insulted Jackie, as it has insulted me, as it has insulted the entire Negro race." Paul Robeson, Jr. agrees with this assessment. At the Long Island University conference on April 4, 1997, which I hosted, he put a different spin on the Robinson-Robeson controversy. His illustrious father had said, in effect, "Hell no, we should not go," and not "Hell no, we won't go." Both Robinson and Robeson, heroes and a double play combination for the ages, blasted racism. At one game, the younger Robeson recalled that he wanted to get Jackie's autograph. Big Paul, however, demurred. He did not want to embarrass the young Dodger star. The Peekskill riots that followed in the summer of 1949 show how polarized America had become. Unwavering in his support for the Soviet Union, Robeson suffered a loss of income. His income, in fact, went from $100,000 a year in 1947 to only $3,000 in 1950. He lost his audience. 1 year later, his passport was revoked. Unable to travel, he lived in virtual house arrest in his own country. But he refused to go gently into that good night. He raged against his persecutors. Critic Eric Bentley captures Robeson's feisty exchange with congressmen in 1956. By any civilized criterion, he observes that the great singer was singled out for depersonalization by the American power elite. The mirror image of Soviet treatment of dissidents began with the second Peekskill riot, in which Robeson was actually targeted for assassination. The honor guard, including Henry Foner, the great labor leader and the author of the introduction to our book, acted up to protect him. His group flushed out two nests of snipers nestled in the foliage. Unable to eliminate the man of courage, Robeson's enemies curbed his travel, curtailed his income, canceled his concerts, and consigned him to oblivion. Bentley concedes that Robeson showed a flawed sense of history when he linked Stalin with Marx, an error that he shared with many communists globally. But the astute critic wisely points out that Robeson's defiant words anticipate the black freedom and black nationalist movements of a later decade. The testimony that he gave under duress on June 12, 1956, put him on a collision course that ultimately led to a contempt citation. He proved more defiant than the inquisitors had reason to anticipate. Proudly, indeed contemptuously, he peppered the inquisitors with pointed questions of his own. It appears that the repeated denial of his petition for a passport freed Robeson from restraint and gave vent to a righteous indignation. He demonstrated utter contempt for the members of this committee, and rightly so. Witness, if you will, these words of defiance. What do you mean by the Communist Party? Would you like to come to the ballot box when I vote and take out the ballot and see? Chair, you are directed to answer the question. After consultation with counsel, Robeson took the Fifth Amendment. But in response to continued badgering by counsel Ahrens, Robeson corrected the chronology regarding his alleged remarks about the refusal to make war on the Soviets. In the absence of hot war, Robeson quipped, so I was prophetic, was I not? Ahrens read Robeson's 1949 statements into the record, but persistently refused to allow the singer activist to read his prepared statement. Robeson countered, the Smith Act is a vicious document. Rather than defend Joseph Stalin, perhaps an untenable stand anyway, Robeson attacked the American record, which wasted millions of people dying in slave ships and on plantations. And don't you ask me about anybody, please. Even if these figures are somewhat inflated, they cut to the heart of Robeson's fierce anger. And if Paul Sr. misjudged Stalin, he accurately captured black rage. He also anticipated the black militancy of Malcolm X. His finest hour came, however, when he blasted Chair Francis Walter for his authorship of bills to keep colored people out of America in favor of Teutonic Anglo-Saxon stock. And in a response to the old cliché question posed by Representative Scherer, why do you not stay in Russia? He replied, because my people died to build this country, and I'm going to stay here and have a part of it just like you. Paul Robeson was one of a handful of dissidents who spoke out against the Grand Inquisitors during scoundrel time. Now that the Cold War is over, it is time to assess the confrontation, or more accurately, the setup that pitted two African-American giants. Right after the first Peekskill riot, reporter Bill Mardo approached Jackie Robinson on August 28, 1949. He gave the Dodger Star a newspaper account of the sordid event. After looking at it, Robinson angrily asserted that, quote, Paul Robeson should have the right to sing, speak, or do anything he wants to. These mobs make it tough on everyone. It's Robeson's right to do or be or say as he believes. They say here in America you're allowed to be whatever you want. I think those rioters ought to be investigated. End of quote. Perceptibly, he concluded that anything progressive is called communism. Bill Mardo demonstrates that these two alleged combatants were actually on the same side. He calls them, appropriately, a double play for the ages. Near the end of his life, his very creative but short life, Jackie Robinson, with deep regret, admitted his error in an aptly named autobiography, I Never Had It Made. I quote, however, in those days, I had more faith in the ultimate justice of the American white man than I have today, 1972. I would reject such an invitation if offered now, end of quote. Although Robinson insisted that he never regretted the statement per se, in a searing confession he wrote, I have grown wiser and closer to painful truths about America's destructiveness, and I do have increased respect for Paul Robeson, who, over the span of that 20 years, sacrificed his career and the wealth and comfort he once enjoyed, because I believe he was sincerely trying to help his people. Unfortunately for the great singer, the divide-and-conquer strategy proved effective. Like a protagonist in a Greek tragedy, the heroic Paul Robeson was brought down, ostracized, and exiled in his own land, the America that he exalted in his famous ballad, The Ballad for Americans. Because of his spirited defense of African liberation and American-Soviet friendship, Robeson's passport was revoked by the State Department. He was redlisted from 1950 to 1958. Unable to travel, to concertize, his income plummeted. He fought back. He lectured the notorious Representative Walter of UAC on the twin dangers of racism and McCarthyism in a democratic society. Eventually, after 8 long years, protest, pressure, litigation, and common sense led to the restoration of his right to travel. He conducted a triumphal concert tour in a powerful performance witnessed by the speaker/writer. Robeson evoked the magic Moor, Othello, in 1959 at Stratford-on-Avon for the last time. His triumphant return to center stage was marred, unfortunately, by a lingering illness. He drifted into a twilight zone of mood swings and periodic depressions. Persecution and struggle had taken a toll on this noble warrior. Unable to sing or speak out, Robeson was pushed aside by a throwaway culture. While an older generation of radical white as well as black activists continued to honor the memory of Paul Robeson, young Americans, including my students, are woefully ignorant of his contributions. Perhaps they need to hear the strains of Old Man River or the resonant words of Neruda to induce what critic Edmund Wilson called the shock of recognition.
Old Man River, that old man river, it don't say nothing. You must know something. Oh, old man river, he just keeps rolling along.
You've been listening to Joe Dorenson, professor of history at Long Island University, speaking on Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. And our special segment on Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson was recorded at radio station WNYE in New York City, Erwin Gonchak, producer. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.